Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank Dr. Friedman and CLMA for inviting me. I hope in the next 40 minutes to cover a whirlwind tour of some of the interests I have in imaging, which is a lifetime interest that originated, interestingly, in film-based photography and has obviously morphed into the digital realm, as has been the case with a lot of the earlier presentations we've seen at this presentation. So without further ado, we'll get into the presentation. I'd just like to obviously mention some disclosures, although the presentation, as you will see, is really agnostic to any particular brand or vendor. It's really about the capabilities and the technologies, which I think we're going to be seeing in the very near future. So talking about search, perhaps this is an interesting analogy. A few arbitrarily scattered letters on a PowerPoint screen. And it's amazing how little extra information you need to create a realm of noise. But when you take away the noise, you end up, hopefully, with the key information, which in this case is the word search, although I don't know if you can see the E. I think it's in there. The key point being that as pathologists, there is a disparity between what we practice in our minds and in the art form of surgical pathology and also the tools that we have available to us to carry out that task. And the disparity I speak of is the fact that the fundamental tool of search in the year 2006 for the web, for our local information systems, is largely, if not exclusively, that of text, which is a problem. So what I'm going to try doing in the next few minutes is cover maybe the history of search in a very, very general sense and some of the fundamental search concepts, and of course these will be in the text realm, and show how they actually have very analogous and equivalent mappings into the spatial domain. And in order to do that, it's going to be necessary to delve a little bit into complexity theory and a little bit into algorithms, although I present them in the context of this type of audience and forum, mostly for general information and perhaps for amusement. I'm not expecting you to understand all the algorithms, nor will there will not be a pop test at the end of the presentation, although I think you'll find some of them entertaining, to say the least. And in mentioning that, complexity theory, as it applies specifically to histopathology, is becoming increasingly evident as a major tool in understanding of complex systems, complex morphologies, and I think this is just really the very beginning of what will hopefully be a new field or series of fields for understanding dynamically changing, because of course histology is a representation of a dynamically changing organ systems, dynamically changing biology, which of course is manifested in a very, very narrow window, which is just the 2D biology we see on histologic sections. And then to wrap things up, what presentation would be complete without showing that some of this has actually been reduced to practice? So I'll show you some fun toys. They're certainly not meant to be implemented in a laboratory setting or surgical pathology setting, but as little snippets of components in overall search, I hope to demonstrate to you that there really is hope for the notion of image-based search or so-called content-based image retrieval. So if we look about the observations of extant repositories, data mining, what is the typical search modality computationally? Of course, it's text. So we end up with, for example, the standard surgical pathology report. And in our various repositories, we have not one, two, three, but thousands, and in fact, millions of them. In Boston, the collective hospitals of Brigham and the MGH, which merged their information system 2 years ago, have in excess of 3.54 million records, perhaps more, with the ancillary repositories, which represents a wonderful area in which to mine for information. But the limiting factor, of course, is the fact you're mining for text information. So when you're looking for items of commonality, you're looking for text, which matches a search or matches some type of Boolean predicate. And in the sense, you're limited by how well your codification scheme worked if you use SNOMED or if you use ICD-9 codes or if people spelled the diagnosis correctly. It turns out there's several reports, for example, that phyloides tumor can be misspelled as often as it is spelled correctly in your database. So a prudent search would be to carry out the search on the misspelled as well as the properly spelled word. However, the analog in the image space exists. If you have a predicate image which has some type of feature, in this case we're looking at a liver biopsy with a fair degree of infiltrate in terms of an interface hepatitis, which has a unique morphology, it turns out that itself is a vocabulary of search. And so if nothing other in the next few minutes, if you If I'm able to convince you that it is possible to map the vocabulary of text search into the realm of image search, then I will have accomplished my task. So really what we're talking about is a region of interest-based query, taking a small snippet of an image or perhaps a whole field of view, either are acceptable, and saying, I have this field of view or I have this particular section of a field of view. What is this like in the database? And that is really the overall goal. And then obviously as you find more features that match, in the hypothetical sense, you would want to be able to have the computer identify all the areas that fit your particular region of interest. And then go to a database and generate a series or stack of cases which are correlates to the image query which you pose to the database. So that's the holy grail, generating a series of cases or series of images from a predicate source image. If we look at some further observations of anatomic pathology, we realize that we are largely visual, and yet all our tools are text-based, again, emphasizing that disconnect. And I want to make a little bit of a segue now into whole slide imaging, which was very elegantly presented already by Mark Tuthill, in that whole slide imaging is on our doorsteps as a real technology. It is merely a question of when the technology will speed up to the point of becoming commoditized. That is to say, so common that you make a business decision based on features, affordability, amortization into 5-10 years of use, just as you would now a large chemistry analyzer or any other type of laboratory instrument. We're not at that point now, and I can't say exactly when it will be, but if we look at the technology as it progresses, and we'll look at Moore's Law, which is, of course, from the chip industry as an example, it's reasonable to infer that it won't be that long from now. When you tie whole slide data, which is this wonderful opportunity to take the entire realm of histology, which has largely been confined to slides, glass slides, which are kept in physical space in a slide file room where they can be lost or have to be physically retrieved for rediagnosis or comparative purposes, once that information is available in the digital realm, it creates tremendous opportunity to ask questions in real time in the digital space, which are not possible now. We have a predicate for this, so we know this clinical diagnostic model works, and that is radiology. Actually, presently, we can see 30 to 40% penetration of the diagnostic clinical radiology departments where they've gone to complete computed radiography. That is to say, they've removed film, they've made primary diagnosis off a digital screen, and they have the ability to do longitudinal patient studies based on prior and present digital diagnostic imagery. How has this changed radiology? Well, it's improved accuracy, it's improved longitudinal continuity of care in that they are looking at the appropriate prior diagnostic information when rendering current diagnoses, and it's allowed them to share information in a seamless, portable, and very timely way that makes their practice value added. If you look at pathology, we simply can't do that. If you look at the sum total data that comes out of histology lab right now in terms of slides multiplied by probable data digitally per slide, it's intractable in terms of the number of information bits, bytes that are generated on a daily basis. But this will change in the short term, as we will see. If we look at what is present case search using technologies available right now, this is a typical type search algorithm, we see the reality that we have various types of granularity based on whatever the limitations of the original database are made. The reason I point this out is this is artificial in terms of how it maps to the actual histology, to the glass slide. We have chosen various fields, one of them being, of course, the all-important diagnosis, but that is not a one-to-one mapping to the slide, because we all know, besides the primary diagnosis, there are multiple other pathophysiologic things happening on a slide, and that may or may not be contributory to a search that you would be interested in carrying out. So we're highly constrained. If we're looking at a simple model where we want to look for things, we have, of course, the standard Boolean predicates, and or not. And then, of course, with SQL, you can have near and like. So if you wanted to find adenocarcinoma near the word recurrent, certainly you can do that now. But what about a more abstract question? Let's say you wanted to look for histologically or in image space adenocarcinoma near the perineural area, and you wanted to see all your previous cases of a particular type of adenocarcinoma that had perineural invasion. That may or may not be something you could easily carry out with a digital database in text form. It's something which could be possible in image-based query. So the typical type scenario, of course, you type in an unusual entity you're looking for. In this case, I typed in the ultra-rare entity nisidioblastosis, and we get about 28 cases exactly from our large repository. The reality is, of course, you don't know really what you're getting. You're getting multiple organ systems. Besides getting pancreas, you're getting gallbladders. You're getting, because of there might be previous history of nisidioblastosis, depending on how the text is formatted in the query, a very nonspecific type of tool. Whereas if you're thinking about what we as pathologists do in rendering diagnoses and comparing to our experience set, we are matching one-to-one our current field of view in the microscope with our experience of diagnostic entities, and that is an image comparison, one-to-one. So there really is a need, if you compare pathology in terms of the practice setting, the mindset, for image-based content retrieval. So if we think of The Thinker by Rodin and what he might be thinking, if this is, we're a pathologist in the morning, what does this case remind me of? What cases does this particular tumor remind me of? At 10 a.m., maybe the question is, this case looks like a case I saw last week. How can I describe that? And 2 a.m., what are the fundamental pathogenesis going on? Of course, people are nonlinear. There's deterioration at the end of the day, and so perhaps as you're getting tired with a very, very large case sign out, you might be asking about why your golf swing is deteriorating at the end of the day. My point of all this is that without the tools to really assist in pathology diagnosis, that is to say being confined to just text, I think we're missing the opportunity to augment and enhance the level of practice that we carry out. And the predicate we have for this, of course, is radiology, where we see that radiology and radiologists have benefited from being able to compare images on an image-by-image basis, having the information available in a digital digital realm. So surgical pathology is largely visual, and yet we're text-based. I can't emphasize that point enough. And this functional gap really is a representation of the historical difficulty of getting all the information in the digital realm to begin with. So I'm just showing you now the fundamentally enabling technology, which is really just a silicon chip, the CCD. It follows Moore's law, and it allows the capability of what's known as wide field or whole slide imaging. The fundamental difference between this and just taking a digital image is now you've removed the problem of sampling. You have the entire sum total data of information in a surgical pathology slide present. And if it were the case, for example, of cytology, it is possible even to sample and digitize an entire continuum of Z data and generate that as well. And I'll just show that to you as a simple demonstration. This is a cytology of herpes. Again, you have the XY component, very easily rendered, whole slide imaging. And now we have fluid motion focus. Again, this technology is available from multiple sources reduced to practice. So the question of getting the information now into a system, whether it be histology or cytology, is a moot point. It's available. So then the question is, what can you do having the entire data set available? That is the opportunity. If we look at where this has come from, we've seen originally small sets, then they're getting larger. Originally, we've seen single acquisition planes. That's now getting to the realm of multi-planar. And larger sets afforded by higher compression with JPEG 2000. And with the optical path engineering approaching that of the resolution limit, as Dr. Tuthill correctly pointed out, in a very short period of time, with adequate optics within the scanning devices, as well as high-quality rendering displays, the quality of sign-out on a digital screen will probably be preferable to the microscope in that it is less fatiguing. It's simply a matter of growing accustomed to doing primary diagnosis off of a screen, but it has certainly demonstrated itself as being very, very practical. If we look at the competing factors for wide field microscopy, there's compression ratio. For compression, as obviously these information sets can be huge, versus resolution, and they're diametrically opposed. I mention this merely to show a historical context in that this was a problem perhaps 2 or 3 years ago. With algorithm design, this is largely going away, so it is possible to have the highest resolution really diffraction limited, 0.25, 0.3 microns, and at the same time have sufficiently high compression without image degradation that it is possible to store the entire sum total set of slides coming out of a radiology lab or histology lab. So the reality is the question that one really should ask is when will we hit economies of scale in terms of manufacturing these devices such that it is possible to make a fast enough and high resolution of scanner to capture the sum total output of a histology laboratory. And that is happening this year, next year, and the next very, very short period of time. So if we look at the total data set, which is represented by a single slide, you can do the math, and it comes to about, in raw data, about 20 gigapixels per image, which used to be a very large amount, but with larger storage and better internet capability for transfer, this is not a daunting task. And if you look at radiology, radiology data sets are relatively small. Even the spiral CT is dwarfed by histology data. So this is an elegant example of why radiology has led the field, led the charge in implementation of digital diagnostics and practice. But pathology is not that far behind. So as I mentioned Moore's Law earlier, I just want to project out in the future where we were at 2000, which was the first enabling point. If we look somewhere around 2010, we see that we're getting to a realm where it'll be possible to generate scans of slides in such a short period of time that are of high resolution that a small number of machines, 2, 3, 4, could scan the entire output of a day's slide production of a moderate to busy histology lab. So again, looking at Moore's Law as it applies to CCDs and scanners, which are the enabling fundamental tool of the wide-field imager, it's really a question of time when the value proposition of these devices will make it possible to shift from optical-based histopathology for diagnostics to digital-based histopathology. So in my mind, it's not a question of if, it's really just when. I'm not going to make a prediction about exactly when, but I can show you just by the progression of technology that it will happen in our lifetime, sooner probably than later. So given that as a predicate, the fact that it is now, right now, possible, of course, to scan the entire output of a single slide in diffraction-limited quality, that is to say diagnostic quality, what can you do with one slide? Or more importantly, if you scan one slide and then a small repository of similar type slides, is it possible to make some statistical comparisons from one slide to the other slides in the image space, not in the text space? So nothing we're going to look at from now on is on text. If we look to the events leading to the present that have enabled this, it really is the thing. The situation that set this up was the initial difficulty with the large data, which is no longer the case, but it was a problem a few years ago, and that was largely compression. Compression for cytology proficiency testing, compression needed to send images over long distances with a relatively low bandwidth internet connection. And as a result of looking at various compression algorithms, a byproduct of that emerged, which was, again, founded in complexity theory. And that is to say that compression itself is, yes, it's useful for sending images or storing things, but it has an extra value, which was not immediately evident, but is becoming evident. And this is where we get into the mathematical aspect of the presentation. That is the information theory. If we have raw data representing, for example, an image, and we compress it, and then we decompress it or restore it, and it looks largely like the original image because we haven't damaged it, you have a realm here where really the same information present in the original image is somehow represented in that compressed space. Here's the opportunity. If the information is here as well as here, but this is smaller, if you can cleverly encode the information so that you can search the smaller set space, the computer could be much more efficiently programmed to search a small set space than a large set space. So I surmise to you that compression is not just for the sake of compression, but is an opportunity to carry out searches far more quickly. So therefore, the predicate is if you have more compression, you have faster search. If you have enormously high compression, you have enormously fast search. That's what I'm going to show you today. A forgotten algorithm from the late 70s, early 80s, largely used by the Space Reconnaissance Office and a national security agency for looking at satellite imagery. They had these large data sets well ahead of all the healthcare specialties. And what was discovered is that if you take an image and chop it up into little bitty snippets, which represent local domains, and these snippets are nothing more than clusters or families of pixels, it turns out that in time you identify repeating themes of these clusters of pixels, and each cluster or family of pixels can be represented as a single cumulative vector. And so-called the vector quantization is taking the source imagery and chopping it up into little bitty vectors. So if we have an example here of a pancreatic adenocarcinoma, and I have a little box here, this is a vector. So this is about 60 by 60 pixels. So we do the math, and this is a 3,600-dimensional space, because each location represents one dimension of a much higher vector. The point of this being, it's compressed, and I'll show you that in a minute, but at the same time, the vector itself is human queryable, because the vector is a thumbnail. It's an image, which makes it very useful for testing. So in vector quantization, you take a family of pixels and you vectorize it. That's all vector quantization is. It's a little bit trickier than that because we deal in color images, so these are actually triplets. So that 3,600-dimensional space is actually 3,600 times 3. But still, it's a high-dimensional space, which for me or you is difficult to visualize. We kind of stop after three or four dimensions. For a computer, though, high-dimensional spaces are really no different to operate in than low-dimensional spaces. So what is vector quantization? It's really the opportunity to take original vectors from a target or source image and compare them against an established vocabulary of vectors. They will either be similar in a one-to-one correspondence place, like one vector, another component pixel, another component pixel. If, in fact, you have a match, you simply, in the compressed space, represent that match by putting the address of the vector that matched. And what this allows you to do now is encode a really large chunk of pixels with a single number, hence your compression ratio. But at the same token, this vector can be immediately be converted back from a number to an image. So you've compressed your image now into a small set of numbers and the overall vocabulary which represents each number. So it's not really formally image compression. It's image segmentation. And the trick is, for telepathology, you post-coordinate the vocabulary on the receipt side, which means you have to spend a lot of computational time up front to generate these vocabularies, which is really the brunt of all the work which has led to the ability to do this. Once you post-coordinate that, though, to send the image is nothing more than sending a stream of these representative numbers or addresses to this table, which then the recipient site converts this table back to an image and generates an image very, very quickly. So this is known generally as an asymmetric algorithm. It takes a lot of work and effort to build the vocabulary, but once you've done that, compressing is fast because you just map to the particular vector, and then you can restore the image by having a locally placed vocabulary which takes each number, converts it back to the image. Okay, so vector quantization is a great tool for compression, but it has opportunity in the realm of diagnostics. And to identify that opportunity, we're going to sort of turn tables now to a completely different field, which also has very high dimensional space, and that's galactic dynamics. Seems completely unrelated, but they're actually synonyms in many ways. If you look at one galaxy, which is a million variables, which is the velocity and trajectory of each star, and let's say another galaxy colliding into each other, intuitively, what do you think the chances are of one galaxy collides into another of two stars hitting each other? Very high? Very low? Excellent. That's true. It's very, very low. Actually, the number is so small, it's less than the lifespan of the universe. So in a typical galaxy, it probably hasn't happened. The number is about 1 in 10 to the 19 years for the typical size galaxies colliding, which means it basically doesn't happen. So if we map this now to the vector quantization realm, and we multiply all those vectors together for a given class of diagnosis, and we'll see how this models, and we project this in a way which can be visualized, which is a two- or three-dimensional projection. If you do, in fact, have a true diagnostic entity in N space versus noise or the edge of chaos, what are the chances, do you think, of something happening in N space, which is a cluster due to random events? Again, the galactic dynamics theory predicts that the number will be exceptionally small, that you'd have a misdiagnosis in N space due to a misrepresentation of these matching vectors. You can take an N space vector and project it on a 2D plane. This is known as a Voronoi map, where each vector is really in N space, but now when projected on 2D space, occupies some least distance where this connectivity map shows the closest neighbor distance. So every point in this white space is a point that's closest to this centroid of a vector as opposed to any other vector. And this is also known in the biotechnology or the bioinformatics realm as the k-means algorithm for identifying true centroids of statistically significant and distinct populations. If you map these now to metadata, such as the diagnosis or a feature of interest within a histologic image, and you pre-coordinate that, you can generate unique diagnoses. So in astrophysics, the question is, what is the incidence of two stars colliding? In histology, what is the likelihood of two comparable tensors sharing a common region of N space for given stringency and being different diagnoses? And the answer is, it's extremely unlikely, as I mentioned, very, very large number, which means then you can use vector quantization for taking vocabularies of disparate tissues and asking a question, is this a match or a non-match? And so you start out with an original predicate image, you compare it with your vocabulary, and if all goes well, you identify matches or mismatches. And this is where we get into the realm of complexity theory and histopathology. And that is to say that histology is repetitive. Cytopathology is repetitive. And as you have vectors, you end up accumulating more and more incidents of things that look similar to each other or different from each other. And it's a statistical asymptotic accumulation, again, using the Voronoi map as a projection. And what this basically means is if you sample enough images and you sample enough cases, eventually you will saturate your system with things that you have seen before, to the point that with the original Voronoi map, if these are unique statistical clusters where the brighter green is a higher statistical incidence, as you go to higher and higher dimensions, you'll notice that this is constricting. And the main point of this is that with increasing cases and increasing images, statistically you either converge or diverge from a match of a diagnosis or a match of a feature. The Voronoi function itself is ugly, but the computer doesn't care. It simply can apply the Jacobian and the other elliptical functions to give you a simple number, which is going to be a probability between 0 and 1, which is really what you want when you're matching items. When you project this, and this is another way of projecting a Voronoi map, in terms of the statistical probability map, we have crevasses which represent low probability of diagnosis. We have areas that are peaks that represent higher probability and plateau at 1, which represents a complete convergence on a match. So if you had an area and space that had this feature, you would know, for example, that these two features were a match between your predicate image and your database. Interestingly, when you look at the increasing size of the vocabulary, you start out with relatively small peaks that become more distinct and extremely sharp, again, highlighting the fact that increasing number of samples statistically helps you in converging or diverging. If we look at the case of divergence, if we have, for example, 4 unique diagnostic components of an image, moving off to an area which is noise, this is, and you look and you start analyzing image for comparison, and you end up with this type of pattern in N space, that's telling you this is a divergence, this is a mismatch. So then in statistical space, that's what a mismatch looks like. So you can see there's a very, very significant and real boundary in the dynamics of complex systems between things that are similar and things that are dissimilar. That's the whole point of this presentation. So if you use that as a predicate, one can hypothesize that you can actually do region of interest-based query in histopathology and therefore generate an album of similar cases from a current case. So why is this taking so long? Well, if we look at conventional image analysis, we have the reality that there are specific tasks, and people over the years have written a myriad of dedicated specific algorithms to solve a specific problem. If you step back for a minute and look at vector quantization and n-space algorithms know nothing about the image space that they're looking at. They just know that sets of pixels match each other or are dissimilar. And they're similar or dissimilar with a level of statistical rigor, which can be tested mathematically. Additionally, there's no end-user customization. You don't have to be a programmer to do this type of program. You simply use an established vocabulary, and things will either match or they will not match. And obviously, these are designed to improve with increased pool of source imagery. So as you grow your vocabulary, as you grow your repository of images, this algorithm will only get better. And it has an intrinsic, it's subtle, but intrinsic value, which is not present in the other algorithms, which is a class distinction. If you train, for example, an algorithm to recognize normality by giving it a pool of normal images, particular abnormal diagnostic entities, adenocarcinoma, inflammatory infiltrates, necrosis, it will recognize those. Let us say you present an image which is not known to the classes, not known to the vocabulary. It will not flag it as normal. It will not flag it as one of your predefined diagnoses. Rather, it will flag it as having a high preponderance of distinct but hitherto unclassified sets of vectors. In other words, it's a powerful tool for showing you a case that has something which is unusual that might otherwise get missed. So the derivative examples that come out of this is the simple query by example database, where you can start with predicate images and in real time ask the database, what is a match? And at this point, with just going through the overall flow, I'll go to the demonstration so you can see how that works. One starts out by obtaining the raw digital information. Again, we use vector quantization to classify it into unique feature areas, which become the distinct vectors. Then we classify those vectors into spaces in N space, which either converge or diverge with a particular diagnosis or diagnostic entity. And then using nothing more than a simple Bayesian inference engine, generate an output, which is a number between 0 and 1. This is the Jacobian that I mentioned earlier. And then this overall system, which is known as a Bayesian belief network, can be designed to be organ-specific, and that allows you now to test new regions or unknowns against your established database. So let's look at a Generation 1 tool to do that. This is the first generation tool. And this tool is nothing more than it's real time, because it's doing hundreds of vectors per second. We're actually hundreds of thousands of vectors per second. And as you can see, we're looking at this point on two simple vector matches. We're looking for adenocarcinoma, and we're looking for necrosis. And as you can see, if I go to the edge of this infiltrating malignant gland, it's identifying the atypical epithelium consistent with well-differentiated adenocarcinoma. Here, it's identifying tissue necrosis. And this is being done now, comparing the particular vector around the mouse or the cursor with an established vocabulary of about 7 gigabytes of data. And you can see this can live comfortably on a laptop. The actual system that has authored this has about 15 terabytes of storage at this point. But you don't need all that data to do a simple example. The second generation tool takes the same idea, except now allows you to look at confidence intervals. In other words, yes, we think this is adenocarcinoma, but how statistically likely is this adenocarcinoma? And as we move around, and I have two features on this one. Instead of necrosis for this particular match, I chose lymphocytic infiltrates. So as we move around, we can see that in this area we have a 72.5% likelihood that this area highlighted by the cursor is a lymphocytic infiltrate. And of course we look at it, and in fact it is. We've got one right here. If we go right in the middle of it, we can see we're getting around 97% right here, 98, 97. Let's pick an area that doesn't look like one. And we've got a no match, or very, very low. So let's now turn our attention to the glands, which in this field look malignant. And look at that, 100%. We go to the lumen, which is nothing, and it's a zero. Go back to the glands. If we go to the edge, we can see that the feature match is tapering off. And as we go away from the malignant gland, we lose our match down to the level of the background stroma. So now using the inference engine, it not only can be Boolean, yes, no, it gives you a confidence interval. Because, of course, the more variables you have, the more statistically significant the ability to render diagnoses. Okay, that's second generation. Let's go to third generation.
What's the discrimination of your
Oh, it's looking. That's looking at 60 by 60. So that's, again, the same predicate, a 3,600-dimensional space times 3, because it's RGB data. Okay, now here's we're getting closer to a tool that might be used in a clinical diagnostic system. I can move around in real time. Again, I've got my lymphocytic aggregate. This is the same image as the prior image, by the way. And I can log in. Look at that, 100%. I go out to the periphery, drops down to zero, no match. The lymphocytic aggregates are working, however, and you can see the confidence intervals there. But more importantly now, as I move around, you can see the number of constitutive vectors in the overall library or vocabulary that are contributing to that match. And so when you get areas of very low numbers, like 74, you get no match. You need high numbers of matches to create diagnostic accuracy.
Land on the left where the top looks semi-normal.
Here? Right. The thing, this is a pancreatic adenocarcinoma, which can have normal-looking epithelium. This has been trained against other pancreatic adenocarcinomas, so it's apples and apples. So you raise an excellent point, but again, since it's apples and apples, its predicate match is on the same peer group, and therefore it's saying, well, non-directed. It doesn't know what it's looking at. It's just saying, well, it looks statistically like what you've told me before, and so it's saying it's a match. But if you go out in the lymphocytic stroma, like right here, because we're getting some, actually there's some malignant cells here, but this area looks pretty much free, and we can see the adenocarcinoma is not showing up, and you're getting a 99.6% for the lymphocytic infiltrate. Now, here's the next step, which makes this as a third generation tool useful. You can now do the first step to query by example. You have a field of view and you're saying, okay, I know what the definition of adenocarcinoma is vis-a-vis the established vocabulary. Just show me everywhere that you're calling or classifying it malignancy at 100% confidence interval. So if you remember the graphic here, I'm asking it to show me all the areas that are this plateau, which are very, very high confidence interval. And so let's look for that. And in real time, practically, it identifies all the area which it qualifies as adenocarcinoma. If I want to say, no, I want to find things that you think are greater than, let's say, 90% confidence interval, so not as likely, you're going to see an interesting thing happen. Look at the perimeter of the areas that are being classified. It increases. And this makes sense because, of course, things that are on the perimeter are statistically less exact. So if we go to 75 now and reclassify, larger and larger areas qualify. So statistically, this makes sense. And now let's put it all together with the next generation tool, which is that it. Make sure I load it. Okay, this is the fourth generation tool, which now, of course, lets you scan for malignancy. But more importantly than that, based on your current cursor location, we'll go into the established repository of cases and tell you which cases, which accession numbers match. And here we are. In real time, as I move around, it's showing me the accession numbers in the repository, which are matching. So while I don't represent this at all as being a turnkey system that can be rolled into your anatomic pathology information system tomorrow, as proof of concept, it clearly shows that this type of statistical tool holds promise for doing image query and retrieval based on physical image-based criteria and not text. You notice I haven't been typing anything text-wise. It's all about the images, and that's what I wanted to show you today. Thanks.